G'day, and welcome to Follow the Money, the Australia Institute's podcast demystifying the big economic issues in Australia and putting them in plain English. I'm Ebony Bennett, Deputy Director at the Institute, and today I'm privileged to bring you another guest from our Economics of a Pandemic webinar series, the independent member for Warringah, Zali Steggall, in conversation with Richie Merzian, the Director of the Australia Institute's Climate and Energy Program. And together they were discussing the role of climate action in the economic recovery.
On March 23, I'll introduce a climate change bill to Parliament to help us protect our homes, our well-being, our economy and our environment from the changing climate.
The COVID-19 is actually showing how big the global vulnerability is and how little we are prepared.
One of the concerns here now is that decisions made by governments today in response to this crisis could fix us and lock us into the ways we produce and consume energy and emit carbon for years and perhaps even decades to come.
What we need is a serious policy to reduce emissions across the economy.
So it's one of the best ways of bouncing back after the corona crisis would be to boost renewable energy spending in Australia.
Press conferences on COVID-19 and then the Prime Minister responds. He always says we're taking the advice of the scientists. But on this, you're not.
Sure.
Unless you're going to tell me now that you will commit to net zero emissions by 2050.
Well, it's a global commitment that counts.
To ensure that Australia is moving away from fossil fuels to 100% clean, publicly owned renewable energy by 2030.
And put planet and people before profits, where students don't have to take days off school to go on strike to ensure our futures.
Whole countries, whole sections of countries could shut down in order to deal with the virus. When you hear in another context like climate change that big steps that need to be taken, the need to phase out fossil fuels, and people say impossible, how could you do that? People love their SUVs or whatever. No, big things can happen if the mindset changes.
The very transition that we've been waiting for, the opportunity has arrived here in this chaos. Business as usual will not work.
Welcome and thank you for joining us, Zali and Richard. Zali, I want to come to you first. Just to kick us off, you've been quite critical of the National COVID-19 Coordination Commission. Obviously, it's going to be hugely influential. What are your concerns?
Critical is harsh, but I've started raising the questions. There's no doubt we're in an environment where there is an acute sense that whatever stimulus, where the public money goes, needs to be for the long-term benefit of Australians, especially the younger generation, that is going to be burdened with not only the cost of this rebuild and stimulus, but the burden of climate change impacts down the road. So we need to make sure this stimulus is as effective and as long-lasting as possible. What we have is a COVID Coordination Commission that was announced in March at the height, at the peak of the health crisis. There was no warning it was coming. There was no consultation. They were unilateral appointments. There was no terms of reference as to what skills were required on the commission. Now, there is no doubt they are eminent people that are on board, but there are a number of areas and skills that are not represented on the commission. But also, there is simply nothing in the terms of reference were only published very recently, so sometime after it came into effect. And the terms of reference make it really clear that, and I can read, quote it, that they ensure the government receives the most comprehensive advice available to meet the challenges ahead. So that's clearly a really broad purpose, a remit for the commission. And yet there is simply no accountability, no transparency around the guidelines. And so my question in Parliament to the Prime Minister was exactly how can we trust what this Coordination Commission recommends or does if we don't know how it accepts submissions, what the premise of projects or submissions are going to be, how are they going to be judged? There is no public hearings. There's simply no process. And then we do know they are being analysed, projects are being considered and put forward to the Prime Minister for consideration. Now, this is really important to our future. And with the backdrop of sports rorts, I think the Australian people are entitled to demand transparency and accountability. This is our future. This is a spend and a stimulus that is going to seriously impact the future of Australians, and it must be done in an accountable way.
I think it was quite telling just last week when the CEO of the COVID Commission was put in front of the Senate committee, the Oversight Committee, that is supposed to bring some transparency to how we're dealing with the pandemic. And he admitted that the commission was opaque. He admitted he didn't really know what was going on. He didn't know how the commissioners were selected. He wasn't sure exactly what conflicts of interest were declared, what foreign interference laws were being adhered to. And he pushed back on even providing a list of the tasks that the commission was undertaking, despite having access to the entire government in terms of progressing these ideas. And he also admitted that they'd been lobbied from day one by many of the friends and contacts who were able to get in touch with the commission, because there are no public hearings per se. So you just really need to know who to go to. So it just leaves more questions than answers. And it's not the first time we've seen the government veer towards using fossil fuel executives for its economic advice. Just yesterday, we had another example. And so really the question should be asked, you know, whether we are providing enough scrutiny, enough transparency, enough accountability for such an important task is where Australia goes.
Yeah, look, also, I mean, the Prime Minister in his answer in Parliament indicated that this was a question of supply, that the Coordination Commission was making sure our remote communities weren't, were properly resourced, that there were no issues with border closures, and so that transmission and supplies was all going well. Now, I accept they have done a fantastic job as that. We as a country have worked really well. But it's clear their role is not limited to that. I know. I have been speaking for a number of organisations, and it is clear they are receiving and considering projects. The chairman himself is out in the media talking about considering projects. He's reviving this idea of a gas pipeline between Western Australia and the East Coast. Now, economically, it simply doesn't stack up, and yet these are serious projects being put forward without clear guidelines. Now, the IMF came out saying that all economic stimulus post-pandemic should have some clear aspects and focus on decarbonisation, long-term cost benefit, that there should be jobs, and there should be clear accountability of, from an emissions point of view, what these projects will do.
Richie, did you have a question for Sally?
Yeah. So just today, the Climate Change Authority is closing submissions on its review of the climate solutions package that the government's put forward, its main way of actually reducing Australia's emissions. But just yesterday, the Grant King review, which was commissioned in secret, and then the results just came out yesterday, along with the government's quite strong agreement to them, came out yesterday, and they seem to conflict. One is an independent body that's been mandated and legislated to conduct this review. The other was a secret review commissioned by the Energy Minister. Is there a problem with the government circumventing these independent authorities that it creates, and what could we do about it?
Well, I think yes. I think the government is uncomfortable with independent expert-based bodies that come up with answers that maybe they don't want to hear or don't suit their agenda. It's a big reason why with the climate change bill that I'm proposing and I will be presenting to Parliament, we need a clear independent climate change commission. Now, we have a climate change authority that is as you say, submissions are closing for their review. The difficulty is that is a legacy from Labor's policy and has very much been gutted by the coalition government in terms of resources and undermined in terms of its impact. We can see that by having the King Review coming out, circumventing the Climate Change Authority. It's a clear undermining of that review of how the Climate Solutions Fund is going and how current policy is going from a climate and an emission reduction point of view. So we do get back to why the Climate Change Commission is such an important aspect that we need. We need that independence like we have with the Reserve Bank when it comes to our, the steering the Australian economy. We need that independence when it comes to our long-term climate policy and our emission reduction.
I mean, and I guess the other part of that is, to what teeth do these organisations need so that they can actually bite rather than be, you know, independent but then sidelined?
Yes, well, of course, it will always come back to the Australian people at the end of the day. The Australian people are the ultimate adjudicators because they vote and they will determine who is in government and who isn't. I think at the end of the day, though, we do need information, and information is actually the hardest thing around the debate when it comes to our national energy policies. There's a lot of misinformation, and we're seeing that at the moment with this idea that our recovery needs to be a gas-led recovery. We need diversity of power sources, but we simply can't have a focus on one form over others, especially where we have cheaper options when it comes to renewables. Yes, the difficulty is where government circumventing a body is a real question. And it's clear the coalition or the Morrison government and Angus Taylor, the minister, by commissioning the grant review rather than entrusting the Climate Change Authority to do it, is undermining its authority. There's no doubt about that.
I think, Zali, you raised the three words that we're hearing quite often now, especially from our Minister for Energy and Emissions Reductions, which is around a gas-fired recovery. The information, the evidence base to justify why Australia should spend potentially hundreds of billions of dollars of its economic recovery towards gas hasn't really been made. Instead, we just hear this clear call from our politicians, from gas industry executives, who were also being put in quite powerful positions in shaping our economic advice. Again, it was on the front page of the Fin Review today. What are your thoughts around whether Australia actually needs a gas-fired recovery, or whether we should actually be looking at cleaner ways to build back better?
Yeah, look, what I would really like to see is a round table where we actually have this out in the open. So the difficulty we have is that we have the Coordination Commission that is clearly being selective about what it accepts and not. I certainly haven't seen its chair at any point acknowledge a priority to look at projects from a low emission point of view. So if that is not part of his focus or priorities, then clearly he's going to look at projects that don't support that. Now, gas will play a part. Yes, I accept that. But we know that the ISP, the Integrated System Plan from AEMO, indicates that gas will take a 1% to 2% part. So it's just not the size of substance that's being touted at the moment by the minister. Where I'm really concerned is what actually does the private sector need? What are they saying? And I would like that to be out in the open. I would like to see, and I will be calling for, a round table and public hearings with this coordination, if it has to be the Coordination Commission, but if not, with the Prime Minister and the Energy Minister, with the BCA, with AIG, with the superannuation groups, so that we can actually get around the table the information of what the private sector needs to rebuild. What are the priorities from their point of view? Because it's unclear whether they feel listened to by the Coordination Commission. And it's unclear whether they actually feel listened to by the government in what it's going to take to make sure we have a positive recovery. The RBA has said very clearly we can't have a return to business as usual. That will not pull us out of a recession. We have horrendous unemployment figures. We need to have a focus on where the jobs of the future are going to be. What are the industries that have that potential? Now, I spoke recently with Tim Buckley, and he's, you know, there's clear potential when it comes to green hydrogen, green steel, green aluminium. There are really exciting opportunities, but clearly we need the commission, if they are the body that is going to be empowered with making recommendations and advice and assessing the strengths and benefits of projects, we need to know that, A, they are hearing everyone, they are putting everyone around the table, and are they truly assessing everything on its economic merit and not supporting ideology because that's their background. So I really want to see a round table and open hearings so we can all know what is being considered and the basis on which certain projects are getting the green light.
I mean, that seems to make sense. We found out that on day one of when some of the restrictions were coming in, the big energy companies, so some of the biggest polluters in Australia who form the Australian Energy Council, so this is Origin, AGL, Energy Australia, all lobbied the energy minister to delay necessary reforms to the energy market, basically as an excuse to not curtail their demand for their product and ultimately pave the way for more renewables on the grid. And so we're seeing a lot of this lobbying happening behind the scenes. I think a roundtable is good. But at the same time, there's a part of me that questions whether we will really get the honesty that we require from the private sector who seem to play both sides. And a good example is Grant King and the Business Council, which, you know, I think a few years ago claimed that a 45% emission reduction target was economy wrecking without really any evidence to back that up. And that was disastrous in terms of increasing Australia's ambition. So I guess alongside the private sector voices being around that roundtable, is there a need to find a better way to reflect the public voices? And I think about the fact that we're potentially going to put out a petition at the end of this around gas and why gas-fired recovery is not appropriate. Do we need other ways to raise people's voices alongside the private sector in terms of how we recover?
And look, of course, and I think that people's voices are being heard more and more. It's clear for especially younger generations, there are two major focus and priorities for the future, and that has to be jobs and sound economic prospects, but it has to also be a safe future, and that with that comes climate change impacts and reducing emissions. So there's no doubt that it is an absolute focus and priority. It is around the world. We're seeing all countries call for that, looking to green stimulus now. But I think we also need to be pragmatic. I am an advocate that you can't let perfect be the enemy of good.
Sure.
So we need to get everyone around the table. We need to work on this together. And yes, there are parties that have moved their position that maybe in the past were not supportive enough of climate action or reducing emissions. But look, as an ex-athlete, I'm a firm believer on you can't undo the past, you can only focus on the future. So where are we today? Where are our opportunities today in terms of stimulating the economy, having industry and manufacturing that works? We need to attract investment. We need the private sector to feel confident that it can invest. Now, the private sector is miles ahead of the federal government at the moment in terms of committed to a net zero by 2050 and committed to low emission technologies. So we need the federal government to get in step. Another thing I think is really important is actually that we continue with the National Cabinet. Now, the National Cabinet has shown to be a really effective way to deal with nationwide crisis. When it comes to climate change, we know this will be a nationwide crisis. We know we don't have a good national energy policy. The NEG was the last attempt at that, and unfortunately that was scuttled by the instability within the coalition. So I do see part of our future is actually an ongoing national cabinet where we have state governments very committed and very focused on net zero by 2050 and good energy policies. I think that is the way forward for us, and that is where I think, yes, the people have a voice to make sure that's reflected. I think people need to be engaged with this. I think we've all, the health crisis has taken a priority. We have, everyone has been very compliant, which I'm incredibly thankful for. We've done an amazing job and we need to really recognise that. But I really hope the Prime Minister takes really takes note of his actions in that by acting quickly, believing the science, by doing the lockdown, we have one of the best outcomes in the world when it comes to the health crisis. And we have a much shorter lockdown than what was anticipated. The Prime Minister was talking about 6 months of lockdown. Mm. Instead, we've had 5 to 6 weeks. So we have an opportunity. I think what's happened, it really shows when you act decisively early, there are definitely benefits. Now, we know on our emission reductions that if we act early, decisively, there will be a cost benefit to that. It is addressing that massive economic risk that we face in the future. So I would really urge the Prime Minister to take the opportunity that there is trust now in taking that early action to do this on our long-term threat from high emissions.
Zali, we've talked a lot there about some of the problems that are within this current system and how we're approaching this, but we've also seen a lot of recent commentary from, we had Ross Garnaut, Professor Ross Garnaut on the webinar a couple of weeks back, talking about some of the opportunities that are here. And equally, the Australia Institute has put together some design principles for an effective stimulus. So things like targeting employment-intensive industries and areas and industries that have been affected the most, as well as those things that you've talked about going early and those kinds of benefits as well. But I just wondered if you could speak to some of the opportunities of this moment, whether that's renewable manufacturing or, you know, AEMO talking about 75% renewables in the national electricity market by 2025. What are some of the exciting things that we could be doing?
I think we're hearing the talk, you know, that we need to focus on hydrogen is certainly a huge opportunity for the future. And Australia has the capacity to be an energy superpower. We need to be really clear though. We need to be talking about green hydrogen, not grey or blue hydrogen. That's really important. You know, grey, clearly fossil fuel powered hydrogen does not meet the targets of what we want to do from an emissions point of view. Blue hydrogen is simply fossil fuel powered hydrogen, but with carbon capture and storage. Now, that's been in the news a lot again with the Climate Solution Fund and the King Review. Ideologically, ironically, that was my predecessor's policy. It has not proved to be effective. It's a little bit like this white elephant that the coalition sadly keeps bringing out as this cure. To try and make an analogy for people, it's a little bit like you're overweight, you know you need to go on a diet, but you're really hoping actually there'll just be a magic pill that will deal with it without ever having to cut anything out. That is what CCS is. It is not going to be the magic solution to our emissions. We are going to have to change technologies and evolve to low emission technologies, and we are going to have to make some changes. So I do feel really frustrated that hearing the energy minister talk again about CCS and focus on that feels like a deja vu from 10 years ago, and I think it's just really out of touch. We need to focus on where we are now. We know so many technologies, the price of renewables, the deflation rate of renewables has surprised even the most supportive experts. You know, it really has surpassed all expectations. It is undoubtedly where we can hope to get with green hydrogen at a really good competitive price. And it was also what's going to support green aluminium, green steel. These are the areas of manufacturing where we have huge opportunity. Of course, we need to remember, how do we get there? You know, these new technologies don't develop in a vacuum. They develop because we have bodies like ARENA and the CEFC charged to support that development. And so I'm really concerned that the government has failed to date really put its support and really renew the funding behind ARENA to come up with those technologies. The easiest another analogy for people to really understand is think about your mobile phones or think about your desktop computers and how far they've come in the last 10, 15 years. Renewables have have done that and more, and we have that capacity in other industries. So that's where green steel, green aluminium are huge opportunities.
Richie, I might go to you for another question shortly, but just letting everyone know, we've got several questions already in the Q&A, but sorry I hadn't turned this function on. You can now upvote questions and comment on other people's questions, and we'll come to those in a moment. But back to you, Richie.
Thanks. Look, carbon capture and storage is a real bugbear for us at the Australia Institute. It's been something we've been researching for ages. The government spent $1.3 billion on carbon capture and storage and doesn't have a single clean coal project to show for it. And every target that the government has set, the Australian government, it's failed to meet on CCS, but not just the Australian government. Every international organization, be it the International Energy Agency or the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, they've all failed in terms of their CCS targets. So it's been really a loser in terms of picking technologies, but a really powerful marketing tool for the coal industry, but the fossil fuel industry more broadly, to continue with the social license that it has a role to play in addressing climate change, and it just hasn't. And now we're seeing all this failed tech around CCS trying to be imported into the hydrogen conversation to say, oh, we can have clean hydrogen by bundling fossil fuels, using them to make hydrogen and burying those emissions using carbon capture and storage. So it's one failed tech onto another emissions intensive process. And if that fails, which it probably will, you're going to have more emissions because it's more emissions intensive to make hydrogen from gas and coal than just to use gas and coal. So it's a really dangerous way of addressing what could be a really powerful technology of the future, being green hydrogen using water and renewables to create a zero emissions fuel. So I couldn't agree more. I think we have to be very careful. And this King review recommended that we watered down the mandates for ARENA and CEFC to allow them to fund CCS, but also to use our climate funding to fund CCS. And that's really dangerous. Even the industry's own body to fund carbon capture and storage, Coal 21, has been spending more money more recently on marketing campaigns, on rebranding, than actually in investing in research and development. So if even the industry reckons it's a fail, I think that's a good indication that the Australian public should keep far away from it.
Look, we just need sound economic management. Now the coalition prides itself on sound economic management. We have to have, we need to leave ideology out. This is a time of real serious economic decisions being made that will impact generations to come in the next 10 to 15 years. So we need to make sure that money is spent, public money is spent wisely, and CCS is not it.
I went and visited, I think in about 08 or 07, the at that time state-of-the-art most advanced carbon capture and storage project. I think it was called ZeroGen in Queensland, and it was a paddock, and I think it probably still is a paddock. So that's how far that's advanced in the last 10 years, even though we keep getting promised carbon capture and storage. Before we go to questions from the audience, Sally, I did just wonder if you could reflect for me on your experience as a member of the crossbench and an independent member. So often we hear from, you know, the government and the Labor Party, but the crossbench has played a really influential role, particularly in climate policy, over the past, decade as well. So what's your experience been there as an independent member pushing for this kind of climate action and the role that independent MPs can play there?
Yeah, look, I think it's really important. I think really sadly, party politics have completely destroyed climate policies in Australia. It's clearly, I think, the ABC's Four Corners review on Monday night really reminded us all of just how destructive it's been. And I think it's been used for personal ambition at the expense of the public good. And that's really disappointing. I think we've had, some of our chief department heads, I mean, listening to Ken Henry, I was just, we owe them such a debt of having tried so hard and yet failed ultimately. So I think the time for those party politics is really over and people are really tired of it. People actually want sound management. They want to see decisions that stack up against an independent assessment that makes sense for the greater good. And so I think that's where the crossbench is really important. We are not tied to a party line. I am directly responsible and answerable to my electorate. I can address each issue on its merits, and that's really important. But it's interesting because people see the crossbench as opposition, and so, well, why aren't I completely aligned with Labor, for example? That is not my role as an independent. It's to look at the issues, to look at legislation as it comes up and assess it on its merits, how it will impact my community, the nation as a whole, the process, is it good law, what is it seeking to fix? And I think that's what more and more people are turning to because they actually want the kind of integrity and accountability in how you look at policy. So on climate, clearly there's been agendas on both sides. There has been, I think the coalition has really been internally incapable of committing to that long-term necessary policy as a result of certain minority of elements who are prepared to wreck the joint and hold the rest up to ransom. There's been this complete freeze and inability to put forward good long-term policy. That, to me, it's such a contradiction to Liberal ethos and economic management that I find it hard to reconcile, which I guess is why I am, it's why I am an independent, so that I can be, really look at policies and where I think we need to be. So It's been really interesting. The crossbench is a great place to be. I want to see it grow. I definitely think it will ensure better governance and better democracy. What I find interesting is even from both sides of politics that you can talk to backbenchers and they can privately be very on board with certain policy areas, but then when push comes to shove and it's time to vote, they will follow the party line. But even if that is not consistent with their private views or the views they have told their electorate. Now, I find that is in complete conflict with their duty to their electorate. So it's a really interesting situation. Look, I'm a newbie to the game and in terms of the politics of it, but for me it really has to stack up and it's that assessment. So, but amazing people on the crossbench, both, there are people working hard for their communities and to get outcomes.
So we might go to questions from the audience now, and apologies for my cat bombing the webinar in the background. So the first question is from Colin Appelt, who asks, what are the most effective things that an individual can do to persuade the government to take seriously the challenges that climate change will bring and to take action instead of just talking about it? First to you, Zali.
Yeah, look, I think what happened here in Warringah is really telling. Now, this is a traditionally conservative electorate, but an electorate that wants to see action on the important risks that we face, wants to see action on climate change, doesn't want to actually just have to be silenced, wants to have a voice. And you saw in Warringah over the course of probably I'd say 3 to 5 years, that growing trend of people talking about the issues, not being constrained by a party line, but wanting that individuality, wanting that inclusivity when it comes to how you look at an issue. So what each and every individual can do is have those conversations in your area. Who is your MP, both state, look at your local government, what actions your local councils are taking, what your state MPs are doing and what your federal MPs are doing. Hold them to account. If there's one thing I've definitely learned from Canberra is MPs all care about maintaining and keeping a job, and that job is at your decision. You know, every vote counts for them to stay in a job. So it is everyone's responsibility to be informed, You know, don't just follow the trend, but be informed about the facts and the issues. Hold your MPs to account. It's not good enough to say you're going to take certain actions or advocate, but then do nothing about it. So what actions have they actually taken? When have they stood up to their party? The coalition is supposed to be the party of the free vote. So technically, on a moral issue, on a question of principle, an MP can vote in accordance to their conscience and represent their electorates. So if that is in conflict with the where the party line is going, they can cross the floor. They can have a free vote. Demand that of them. Have that discussion. You can't afford to be have a laissez-faire and become complacent about these questions, because the only way you will hold your MPs to and the government to account and MPs to account is if you ask them the question and demand answers. Have those meetings with them. Have the conversations. Go to the local groups, the PNCs in your electorates. That you are all powerful. You need to appreciate your power.
Thanks. And Richie, what's your suggestion there? How can individuals help?
Oh, I think Zali's nailed it. It kind of makes you wonder why the moderate liberals or modern liberals, depending on how you take it, who state that climate change is important to their electorate, and I'm thinking of, say, Dave Sharma, for example, why they're not as outspoken as other members in their party who are on the other side of the fence and are quite outspoken when it comes to no action on climate change or questioning climate change altogether. You seem to hear a lot more from those voices rather than from the moderate liberals who state that climate change is important. And so I guess there's a real imbalance there, and one that can be brought up over and over again, because by claiming you speak for quiet Australians, it really just gives you an excuse to say what you want. And as long as those Australians aren't quiet, then it really hampers that ability. So I think there's a real question there as to why those in particular, and I think your climate action bill is a good example. If they really do believe in climate action, then that's a good way for them to voice their support or at least talk to you about the good things within that they can work on. And so really getting involved in politics is just part of the picture.
Yeah, sorry, I was going to say also, but individually, people have that power. We are all consumers, so we can choose where we spend our money. I think the private sector is miles ahead of the government at the moment in terms of it knows from, large corporations know their customers want them to be focused on lower emissions, and their shareholders want them to be, and their employees want them to be. So there is a clear focus on those priorities when it comes to the private sector. And because you do, each individual has power in the decisions we make. That's why here in Warringah, we, for example, started the Warringah Roadmap to Zero, which is a way to empower everybody on a local micro way, looking at their finances, where is your investment, where is, are you supporting institutions that are making sound climate decisions, and or are they institutions supporting fossil fuel companies and investment? What decisions you make personally, I think we all can make a difference, and we have to be focused on the big picture, but also the small picture.
The next question comes from Lucy Vanderstelt Goo, I think, and she asks, given the lack of enthusiasm for climate action at a federal level, what should state governments who have typically shown more enthusiasm for climate efforts be doing to ensure a green recovery? Perhaps that's a little out of your remit, Zali, but I'm sure you speak to state parliamentarians as well. What's your view?
Look, I think the states are doing much better and are more proactive. I look at we have all states and territories either committed either in policy or legislation to a net zero by 2050. They are in step with the private sector and most countries around the world. In contrast, we have the Energy Reduction Minister yesterday reaffirming that it is not the Morrison government's policy to get to a net zero by 2050. So it really begs that question of, are they even committed to the Paris Agreement? Because we know that's what's required. So what I would say is, yes, the states are much more future focused because they know they have to deliver services, and they are much more directly impacted by customer confidence when it comes to electricity prices, supply of goods and where things are at. So local government's very important, state government's very important, and I will And I would argue we need the national cabinet to continue when it comes to dealing with our emission reduction and national energy policy. It's clear at the moment we have the government and the minister in charge of emission reduction is the person least committed in Australia to, you know, from a government point of view, to actually reducing emissions. So I think that leaves us in a really big quandary. And I think it's a crisis that a national cabinet structure would deal with much better.
Richie, state governments.
Yeah, the state governments are providing a good example of what a coalition government that believes in climate change can do. I think New South Wales is investigating low emission options to meet its net zero by 2050 target and stimulate their economy. South Australia is potentially going to hit 100% renewable energy in the next few years. And that's a coalition government there that's backing that in. They're looking at green hydrogen in a big way as well. Tasmania, another coalition government that's looking at 200% renewable energy. So these are great examples. And I talk about electricity because electricity is still the most emissions intensive sector of our economy, around 34%. And next after that, tied next is transport. So when you add those two up, you have the majority of Australia's emissions, and both of these are well within the remits for state governments to actually exercise. There's a great role that they can play in actually getting to some of these emission reductions without waiting for the federal government. But at the same time, the federal government does have a key role to play. And a good example of that, which is just going to throw it in there, the federal government is still banking on using these dodgy Kyoto credits to meet its Paris Agreement target. That's the majority of their emissions reductions are going to be basically from these empty hollow credits that they accrued by gaming the international system. And then they're forcing other countries around the world to try and recognize it by pushing it through the UNFCCC. So there's a clear disconnect between what coalition state governments are doing and what the coalition federal government are trying to push.
The next question is from Madhu Venkatesan. I hope I've said that correctly. And Philip Parsons, if you're on the line, I'm going to try and come to you next in person, if we can manage that. Madhu's question is, how do we tackle the powerful fossil fuel industry? To you first, Sally.
Yes. Well, I think we do need more transparency in donations laws to political parties. I must say I was astounded this last year where the reporting requirements on as an independent were so dramatically different to political parties. The breakdown I had to provide as an independent months before a political party was quite astounding. So clearly we need to break down that influence when it comes to the fossil fuels. It is like what the cigarette smoking lobby, the tobacco companies was, and that needs to be broken down. I am really concerned at the level of influence in the Commission as well as the PMO office of ex-fossil fuel executives. So there's no doubt that needs to be addressed. I am a strong advocate for a National Integrity Commission. We need to have more transparency and accountability around decisions and a process by which they can be properly investigated. So I think that's a really important part of our democracy and transparency that needs to happen. Yes, the fossil fuel lobby is incredibly powerful, but you've got to remember within the Minerals Council, it is not just about fossil fuels. There are actually a lot of other minerals and technologies and opportunities that are actually tied to renewables. So it's not just a one-size-fits-all. There's a lot of misinformation, and it's quite amazing how many a small number of individuals are swaying decisions. I was recently sitting on the Environment and Energy investigation into nuclear, and at that point we had the Minerals Council making a submission to us that because we need to lower emissions in our energy sector, we should be lifting the prohibition on nuclear. Now, I support that we have a technology agnostic approach to lowest cost, lowest emission technologies, but it was ironic the self-serving nature of that submission that, and when I put to the official, you know, would he make that call that regardless of putting nuclear, that we needed to focus on low emission energy, he became a little bit less strong in his submission about lowering emissions from our energy production. So I think, yes, they are incredibly influential lobby, but again, I think the focus has to be jobs and opportunity. We have huge other opportunities in other sectors, and those sectors need to speak up. Everyone needs to find their voice.
Thanks, Sally. Richie?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, there's a running joke here in Canberra that there's more coal jobs here in Canberra with all the lobbyists than there are actually out in the field. There's no shortage of influence from the fossil fuel industry in federal politics. Something that the Australian Institute has been working on for decades, including around the greenhouse mafia that shaped Australia's policies around the Kyoto Protocol, which led to this carryover that have shaped government policy since then that helped delay action up until the 2007 election. And I think was a key part of what was missing from the Four Corners on Monday, that there is this deep-seated influence. There's a rotating door between a number of politicians and staffers and the industry as well. And this goes on both sides of the coalition and on Labor. And the solution really is accountability. It's calling it out. It's shining a light on it. It's an independent commission against corruption. It's basically defending our FOI laws. It's using the transparency mechanisms like Senate estimates. It's supporting organizations that do that work. Ourselves, but there's many others as well, and it's finding other means to really raise that. And I think some of the shareholder activism has been quite useful in pushing some of the organizations like BHP and Rio Tinto to question their membership of the Minerals Council if all they're going to do is be a mouthpiece for the coal industry. The Minerals Council, which, you know, a former deputy of the Minerals Council is the chief of staff of Scott Morrison. But I don't think there are powerful links, they're deeply ingrained. But also they've benefited from decades of solid marketing and influence. Our Climate of the Nation survey, which has been running since 2007, found last year that people overestimate the amount of jobs in the coal industry by a factor of 23. And they overestimate the income from the coal industry by a factor of 4. And so the idea of Australia being so reliant on coal and on fossil fuels is also deeply ingrained. So part of addressing that influence is also addressing that misinformation, which is why it's so important, as Ali was talking about, in getting that independent information out there that's not influenced by these stacked commissions that we're seeing more and more of.
Thanks, Richie. Philip Parsons, are you there?
Yes, I am.
What's your question for the panel?
No, I didn't know I had one, actually.
Oh.
I wondered why you called me on. But
you've clearly got your hand raised in the Zoom functions. Normally that means you want to ask a question.
Press the wrong button. But
right.
Zally took on the Monash moron and defeated him, Tony Abbott. So clearly a strong local campaign can influence the position that a member took, and Zali has stressed that point by us taking a local action. But do you think that that things like Extinction Rebellion demonstrations are positive in that sort of local action or negative?
Thanks, Philip.
I'm a little torn, I've got to say. So the way I look at the last 10 years, I guess, of activism when it comes to climate policy is you have a certain percentage of the population that has responded to the more urgent call and the more activist, you know, that this is the emergency aspect. There is another proportion of the population that is not attracted to that kind of message and campaign. And in fact, it pushes them the other way. That level of activism. So I think it's, and I think that's where I'm probably down that centre line, that I want to see a case moving forward where we get everyone around the table, try and seek to understand where everyone's coming from, and find those solutions that are going to be good for everyone. So I must say I am not a high activist person. It doesn't sit with my nature, but it is how it works for many others. And I think it's an important part of democracy. You actually need all types and views to be represented. So you can't, you know, one size fits all doesn't work to everyone. But I think it's also been quite destructive. You know, if those that really Extinction Rebellion resonates with, it's just as negative if they use that platform to really ostracize those that are coming on board, that are now convinced of the need to reduce emissions and climate change, but are incredibly aggressive towards them for not doing it fast enough or quick enough or in the way in which they want. And I think that is where you get, you know, you get division. And I think we need to really stop that. It's not about the blame game. It's not about looking at who's done what, but it is about trying to move forward with a consensus. Now, we know from what Richie was saying, over 80% of Australians want better action on climate change and want decisive action. So that is a strong platform for bipartisan. We should have at least everyone committed to where our ultimate goal is. And that ultimate goal has to be being safer. It has to be staying under 2 degrees, which is a net zero by 2050. So if we could all at least agree on that, you can then have a more rational discussion. So, look, I applaud everyone who is passionate about their beliefs that go out and fight for those beliefs in the way that suits them. It's not my cup of tea, but it's not to say that it has its place. But you can't leave everyone else behind. And I think that's the part of the population we need to remember. An electorate like Warringah is a fiscally conservative electorate, but it is also socially progressive. It cares about our legacy to our, you know, we care about the legacy to our children of the environment we're going to leave and the economic environment we're going to leave in terms of opportunities. We want Australia to do well in the in the markets of the future. Now, coal and mining has played a huge part in Australia's prosperity. We can't it's not about blaming. You have to appreciate we have generations that have built Australia to where it's at, and we are all incredibly thankful. But we do also now need to evolve to where the next opportunities are and where the next technologies are. It's not about a blame game. It's simply about moving to the next phase. And I think what I represent, more that sensible, I'm not an activist, definitely not. But it's trying to find that consensus for everyone to move forward.
Richie, we haven't just seen things like Extinction Rebellion, but also, for example, the school strikes against climate. What's your response to that?
Yeah, I think it's great. I mean, the status quo is not working, obviously. And so to the extent that we have new groups challenge and find different ways to have their voices heard, I think the climate strikes around the schools, the climate strike had an event on last Friday, finding a way to take that on line because they couldn't, well, because I guess in a sense there is a somewhat strike with schools down anyway. And so finding different ways to actually progress that is useful. I think Zali is a personification of basically trying to find different ways to challenge the status quo and running an independent to displace a former prime minister who has been a real handbrake on climate action. So I think all these movements and pushes are useful because if we just continue to expect the same arguments to cut through, then we're just continuing to be disappointed.
Thank you very much. The next question is from Jim Allen. And Zali, he asks, how far off is the climate bill? And events since March are obviously a stark demonstration of why it's needed. But can you give us an update on that one?
Absolutely. Look, we obviously had to delay presenting it to Parliament. It was due for the 23rd of March, and that was right when the lockdown came on. So it is still on the notice paper, and when Parliament resumes to its a more regular sitting, which we now have that approved, we will have that opportunity to have a private members Monday, at which time I will be presenting it. The thing is, I don't want to rush it because this is an opportunity to get it right. Clearly, we have certain aspects that have changed since the crisis, and I think that should be reflected in the climate change bill. And so I want to have those discussions with both sides of politics, and in particular the coalition, in terms of they clearly are comfortable with the concept of a commission since they implemented a coordination commission. Now, one of their main criticisms of the bill was that it was an unelected body advising government, usurping the role of cabinet. They clearly have gotten over those concerns because they've instigated a coordination commission. So I think hopefully that addresses the concerns they had around the Climate Change Commission. Then we look at really where our, you know, the risk management that we need to do that is such a key part of that bill, and locking in the goals. So I want to have those discussions, but I anticipate presenting it to Parliament in the second half of this year. It's still very much on the agenda for 2020. I anticipate in a few months' time that that's when it will be. I do want, though, so many people have invested so much time and effort and energy. This is the people's bill, in that as an independent, I don't have a party machine behind me. What I have is the support of people who are climate conscious and want better policy. They want an end to the climate wars. And I definitely think 2020 should be the year we end the debate and the climate wars in Australia. And that is, I very much put that on the Prime Minister, as that is his opportunity for his legacy. If we want something to look back on 2020 that is positive, then his legacy should be put an end to the climate wars and lock in our long-term future and goal. So I want to have those conversations, but I want to present it to Parliament when we don't have a lockdown, where people can come out and show their support of the bill. So we need to wait till the health crisis has dissipated and we have a change to the measures.
Thanks, Sally. I think we've got time for one last question here, and I've just got a couple of different questions that touch on the energy grid and the electricity market in different ways. So Scott Allen asks if you can address the need for a revitalised energy grid, and that there's a backlog of renewable energy projects waiting to get connected and a reliance on this outdated concept of baseload power. And another person, Bradford Sherman, talking about how incumbent energy companies are using the pandemic to slow down implementation of important reforms. So two questions there, but first to you, Zali, can you speak to those?
Look, yes. We've seen the MOU between, for example, New South Wales government and the minister. The New South Wales government is very focused on its renewable energy zones and getting the transmission up and running in that sense. So the backlog is concerning, because what it's doing is it's really impeding further investment in Australia, and we're seeing a big slowdown of investment in Australia. So that is a real big concern, and something that needs to be addressed. At a time like now, we absolutely need to make sure those barriers to investment are lifted to ensure we keep progressing. So I will be, hopefully, as Parliament resumes, addressing those concerns more directly to make sure that that's happening. But again, the grid and transmission is an issue. We now have a gold-plated the gold plating has played such a big part of the high costs that needs to be addressed, and I think we need a better plan. AEMO has come out with its ISP that addresses that whole discussion of base load, and it's simply not as substantial as what the minister tends to make it out to be. So again, I think it's we need to really be a bit more informed about the reality of the situation, as opposed to sort of maybe beliefs of what's going to be needed. I think, you know, like I look at AGL, for example. We know the Liddell task force has not been released. This is a company who, they're getting squeezed. They have investors on one hand, especially international investors, saying you're not progressing fast enough to lower emission technologies. At the same time, they have the government holding up their process of shutting down Liddell, which is an incredibly unreliable source of power. So I think the government needs to be a lot more proactive in working with the private sector in what they really need.
We're going to have to wrap it up there. So thank you so much for your time today, Zali Steggall. Thank you for joining us.
And I love your black cat.
Thank you. She has featured on a couple of these webinars. But we really appreciate your time today. And thank you, Richie Merzian, for joining us, and to all of you who have joined us today and for all your wonderful questions. I'm sorry we couldn't get to all of them, but they were all great.
This was recorded live on Wednesday, the 20th of May, 2020, and things may have changed since recording. You can check out the Australia Institute's Economics of a Pandemic webinar series at our website, tai.org.au/webinars. Our next event is on Wednesday, the 27th of May, 2020, with Australian Greens leader Adam Bandt talking about a Green New Deal. For the latest health information, you can check health.gov.au or listen to the ABC's excellent CoronaCast podcast. You can visit tai.org.au for all our latest research and content, and we're on Twitter at the Oz Institute with an AUS. My Twitter handle is Ebony_Bennett with a double N double T. Zali Stegall is at Zali Stegall with a double G double L. And Richie Merzian is at Richie Merzian, all one word. This episode was produced by Jennifer Macy, and our theme music is by Jonathan McFeet from Pulse and Thrum. Please stay at home if you can, keep washing those hands, and thanks again for listening.